for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa is unprecedented in scope, with more than 1,000 cases and nearly 700 dead. Here to discuss Ebola, what's being done to prevent it from spreading further, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health and Dr. Daniel Lucy of Georgetown University. Joining us by phone from New York City, Laurie Garrett of the Council on Foreign Relations, and from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Dr. Billy Fisher of the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. And I'm sure many of you will have questions, comments. Join us by phone at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow at wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And thank you all for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Diane.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good to be with all of you. Dr. Fauci, how serious is this outbreak?
Well, certainly for the countries involved, the West African countries, it's really quite serious. As you can see, this is unquestionably historically the worst Ebola outbreak that we've had in history. The first cases were recognized in 1976, and there have been several, almost two dozen outbreaks over those years in a variety of countries. The total amount of people involved in those cumulative have been about 2,300. This already, as you see, have over 1,300 people with about 730 deaths so far. So overwhelmingly, this is the worst. But also because it is going across countries, adjacent countries with porous borders. And now, unlike prior outbreaks, mostly in rural areas, it is now in densely populated areas. So all of those things conflating together make this quite a serious situation there.
Dr. Lucy, how did this outbreak begin? Do we know?
We're not certain, but most likely it began like other Ebola outbreaks where there's an infection in one or more animals that people are exposed to.
Like what?
Like bats, like African antelopes called duikers, like non-human primates, maybe chimpanzees or gorillas. Sometimes these animals are killed for food, so-called bushmeat, and people can be exposed to the animal's body fluids that have the virus in it, and then people can get infected, and then they start to infect other people.
And Dr. Billy Fisher, I know you recently spent 3 weeks treating patients in Kakadu in Guinea. Tell us what you saw there.
It was, from a clinical perspective, it was an intense experience. There was a tremendous amount of both fear and despair around the surrounding community as well as within the population of patients that we were treating. But contrary to what is popularly portrayed in popular media, most of the patients were presenting with really nonspecific symptoms, so vomiting, diarrhea, and in about half of the cases they progressed to have hemorrhagic complications such as bloody vomit, bloody diarrhea.
And how are they treated?
That's a great question, and it was actually one of the concerns that that I had upon being deployed by the World Health Organization to Kakadu. So there is no specific antivirals currently available, and there's no specific vaccines that are licensed for use. There are a number of agents that are currently in the R&D pipeline, but just not ready for use. But what is available is aggressive clinical care support, critical care support. And what I mean by that is aggressive fluid hydration. So many of these patients are presenting with really low blood pressures due to volume loss through diarrhea and vomiting. And if we can get to them early enough, we can keep them hydrated and support them through it. And from my experience on the ground, I was actually able to witness that with this aggressive critical care support, we can reduce the mortality. Mm.
Laurie Garrett, what about these particular countries? What does their history have to do with this current outbreak?
Well, one of the features that, Diane, that we're seeing as a key problem in this outbreak is the resistance of the general population to measures that could conceivably bring the epidemic under control, measures that worked in other outbreaks, including the one I was in 1995 in Kikwit Zaire. Pretty basic things, but scary things for populations, like removing the ill from the care of their loved ones and placing them in quarantine and denying public burials so that there's no contact with a cadaver. And what we're seeing here is that there's massive resistance to these efforts, even attacks on health workers, because these are countries that have in recent time experienced the most brutal civil wars, the most heinous atrocities of human rights violations in modern history. I mean, Charles Taylor is one of the few truly convicted war criminals in modern time, and he was the leader of Liberia. His counterpart in Sierra Leone died of a heart attack when he was facing his own trial for war crimes. Almost every single family in all of these three countries, but especially in Liberia and Sierra Leone, has witnessed horrible atrocities committed against them by rival militias, by governments, by one invading child soldier group after another. And so nobody trusts anybody. And there's no sense of confidence and belief in either government or health workers. And then on top of everything else, these are three of the poorest countries in the world, and they have a 50% illiteracy rate.
And Dr. Fisher, Laurie Garrett just said there is no trust even of the healthcare workers. Surely that is compromising any effort to try to help these folks who might be infected.
Absolutely. That's a critical problem that exists. The first two patients that I actually took care of were a brother and sister who were demonstrating symptoms within their village. Their village contacted Doctors Without Borders. And when that group tried to bring them to the treatment facility, they fled into the bush. And the only reason we were able to get them into the treatment facility were because they became so weak, because their symptoms had progressed, that they couldn't run any further. And unfortunately, by that time, it was too late.
Now, Dr. Fauci, I understand that three Americans that we know of have been infected. One has died stepping off a plane in Lagos, Nigeria. What about the others on the planes in which he traveled?
Sure. Well, what's going on right now is what we call contact tracing, Diane, which means that, first of all, to put it into perspective, it is extremely unlikely, not impossible, but extremely unlikely that individuals on the plane would be infected.
Because
you have to come into direct contact with bodily fluids.
Do we know that for sure?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you say for sure, if you look at the long experience that is now back until 1976, when the first interaction with patients that we know of with the first outbreak in 1976, that it is very, very clear that you have to come into direct contact with bodily fluids, usually vomit, diarrhea, blood, or what have you. Since the person, in fact, was not feeling well, but he was not openly vomiting and whatever on people in the plane, so it is unlikely. However, to be perfectly careful and cautious about it, the authorities in Nigeria, with the help of WHO and the CDC and others, are doing contact tracing to make sure that the people who were on the plane are not coming down with symptoms. But it is very unlikely that there was transmissibility because of the condition of the person while he was on the plane.
Okay. But then we go back to Dr. Fisher's point. Suppose someone has contracted the virus. How would he or she know before symptoms actually begin? In other words, how quickly do symptoms appear after infection?
Well, it's anywhere between 2 and 21 days. And sometimes, you know, if you look at the mean, it's probably around 5 to 10 days following exposure. We call it with the incubation period, where people start to get symptoms. But as Dr. Fisher said, the symptoms don't start off with bloody diarrhea. They generally start off with symptoms that you could maybe not confuse with malaria or a bad flu or what have you. And then when it progresses, that's when you get into the situation where it's clearly much more likely to transmit.
And Dr. Lucy, suppose someone has been infected, is not showing symptoms. For example, these people on the various planes, is there any preventive medication that could be administered?
So if someone has not developed any symptoms, fever, any kind of symptoms at all, diarrhea,
in this 21-day period?
Yes, then by day 22, they are out of the incubation period. They're out of the danger zone. They're not going to become symptomatic. They're not going to develop Ebola virus disease.
Okay. But during that 21-day period, is there anything that can be done?
No. There's no specific treatment available.
That's pretty scary, Dr. Fisher. You must have seen that yourself.
Absolutely. It's terrifying with contact tracing to monitor people. The one thing that I would add, though, that amidst all this despair and this concern and high mortality rates is the hope that if we can get to people early enough in their illness, so as soon as they start manifesting signs and symptoms of Ebola, that we give them their best chance of survival. And so while we can't give them anything that will protect them from developing it, once they develop symptoms, it's critical that we get them into a treatment facility as soon as possible, both to help them and to prevent their chance of transmitting it to someone else.
All right, Dr. Billy Fisher, he's physician, associate program director for research. He is at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. Short break, right back. And welcome back. We're talking about the outbreak of Ebola in three African countries. There have been thus far some 700 people who've died, some 1,300 who may have been affected. And that is the question that a number of people are asking, Dr. Fauci. Is this particular strain of Ebola different from that which we saw back in 76?
No. Actually, the first one was the Zaire strain, and this is very close to the Zaire strain. So when you look at the multiple strains that have been isolated at different times and worked on in the laboratory, this clearly is on the spectrum of very virulent strain.
Very virulent.
But it's like the Zaire strain, which is the most virulent.
Okay. Dr. Fisher, once that patient has begun to develop symptoms, what is your role as a physician? To what extent can you prevent that person from dying?
That's a great question. And we are limited with what we can provide for a couple of reasons. One, as I mentioned earlier, there's no specific therapy for Ebola. But two, this outbreak is occurring in one of the most under-resourced areas of the world. So we are further limited in what we're able to do. But what we're able to do is bring them into a treatment facility, which effectively stops the chain of transmission to other people in their community, and then aggressively rehydrate them and keep up with electrolytes as they lose them through their vomit and diarrhea, and provide aggressive, critical supportive care.
And to what extent is that critical care successful?
So if you look back historically at the mortality rates associated with Ebola virus, it's about 70%. If you look specifically at the mortality associated with the specific strain that we're dealing with, as Dr. Fauci mentioned, Ebola Zaire, it's about 78%. We've been able, with aggressive clinical care, to reduce that substantially into the 40 to 60% range, depending on location of the treatment facilities.
And Laurie Garrett, from your perspective, getting them into those treatment facilities has got to be pretty scary for those people.
Well, it's terrifying for them, and families resist it. The individuals resist it. If I may, Diane, I want to make a couple of points.
Sure.
Because one of the real concerns, every time we see an outbreak of this nature, and of course this one is now by far the largest ever, but anytime we see these things, there's a tendency by the outside world, by the average American, to start thinking, what a scary place. Let's just wall them all off and forget about them and hope that we don't get this virus. And there's a natural tendency for people to think of their own self-interest, their own families, and so on. But we're talking about three desperately poor countries. All the two key leaders, the leader of both Liberia and Sierra Leone, today announced that they're imposing military support for quarantine. They've declared states of emergency in their countries, and both of them are canceling trips to Washington, D.C. for the big Africa summit called by President Obama at the White House. Now, this has huge implications because already many of their neighboring countries, especially Nigeria, and many of their major trade partners, especially the UK, have started to impose certain kinds of concerns, border protections, talking about sanctions against these countries, all of which could drive them into ever, ever deeper poverty, really leave them so deeply scarred that once the epidemic is over, they will have years and years of recovering from the economic impact of all of this. I think it's tragic that these two key leaders are not able to plead their case in Washington at this summit. And I really hope that the Obama administration, the Cameron administration in the UK, and the Africa summit recognize the very desperate need to not only support the battle against the virus, but to also be there to help build these countries back up, help them recover from this desperation, and come up with decent health systems once this is all over with.
When you talk about the Africa summit on Monday, surely these leaders might be able to participate by Skype or some other means to plead their own cases, Laurie Garrett.
Well, I would hope so, but actually, as of the last agenda I saw, the Ebola epidemic is not even on the agenda.
Wow. Dr. Fauci, in the past, in the case of Zaire, in the case of the 76 outbreak, how long did the outbreak last?
It really varies. If you look at the multiple outbreaks, it really varies from several days to weeks to a month or two. It usually breaks, it essentially dissipates itself. But this is really important, and it relates to the point that I made early on, Diane, is that they usually occurred in areas that were relatively remote, which means it could be much more easy to contain in a population that's in a remote village and not really close to cities. One of the confounding issues of this outbreak is the porous borders between three separate countries here, as well as the large populations in getting into the cities. So the earlier ones were dramatic, but they essentially burned themselves out by the kind of infection control mechanisms that were put into place.
And Dr. Lucy, you mentioned earlier that one of the causes here was the consumption of bats, for example, as one source of protein that these individuals are accustomed to eating. Had they been warned off those kinds of foods?
So I should defer to Dr. Fisher and others who have been in the three countries, but certainly that's my understanding from what I've been able to learn from Internet information, that that kind of risk communication has been conveyed. The dangers of getting infected from exposure to animals that have this virus, like many other infectious diseases that come from animals, like bird flu, like the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, like the SARS virus in 2003. So there are quite a few newly recognized infectious diseases of the last 30 years of humans that come from animals.
Dr. Fisher.
So education is a big part of this, and there have been some efforts. In fact, I was met at the airport when I arrived in Guinea by a large placard that announced how Ebola was transmitted. But I think that's one of the critical pieces that's missing in this outbreak, and particularly because this is in such an underserved area, is information infrastructure. So there is not a great way to disseminate a lot of information about how this virus is transmitted and how to protect themselves within all of the villages that are affected.
Aunt Laurie Garrett, if you tell folks you cannot eat a particular food that they rely on, why should they believe you?
Well, I think the lack of belief goes even deeper than that, Diane. I mean, first of all, these countries have an average adult illiteracy rate of 50%. Then you take in what's functional literacy versus the ability to read anything that actually tries to describe what a virus is. You're talking about a very small percentage of these populations. And for most people, the germ theory of disease is not a real concept. You know, Dr. Fauci has been doing battle against the HIV pandemic since the days before, in the 1980s, we even knew it was caused by a specific agent. And, you know, he can tell you that all over the world we have seen populations not understand really what a virus was and how it was transmitted. That's in it for a slow spreader, a slowly evolving pandemic. In the case of Ebola, we're really up against cultural beliefs that when a disease hits a given family, it's because your ancestors committed some sin against some other family, and they have leveled evil spirits against you. It's a kind of sense of an endless sense, set of circles of retribution and revenge for deeds committed by someone against someone else. Well, now add to it, they just came out of these heinous civil wars where indeed evil deeds were done on almost every single family by somebody during the course of the 1985 to 2003 outbreak of violence. And so you have a situation where outsiders are trying to say to people, there's a virus, and this virus causes this disease, and we are outsiders dressed in spacesuits, and we don't look like you, and you should believe us. And meanwhile, the average person doesn't even have a concept of what a virus is.
This happened even in this country when the HIV came here. I mean, there were people who said, you know, this is the result of your hideous behavior. Right. And in Africa, they're saying it's your relatives who did something wrong.
This is nothing new. It's not new to HIV. It's not new to Ebola. History is replete with examples of when there are major outbreaks and plagues. The fear, the terror that is stricken into people has people almost intuitively look to someone to blame, someone, some group, some class, some religion, some country. There always needs to be a reason for things. And if you don't understand, as Laurie was saying correctly, the subtleties of the germ theory of infection, then you're looking to blame people and blame nations and blame groups that have nothing to do with it. So you're absolutely correct. It's a very difficult situation.
Dr. Fisher, from what you have seen so far, do you believe that this particular strain of Ebola and this particular outbreak does have the potential for spreading beyond Africa and into other countries? There is obviously, as you know, a great deal of concern about that.
Sure. I think there is potential. We've seen that somebody who had the virus was able to get on a plane in Liberia and travel to Nigeria. And given the incubation period of 21 days, you can do a lot in that 21 days. The difference is, and I would be more concerned about further spread in other pockets of Africa, mainly because of the the lack of resources that exist in many of the areas, many countries in Africa that would be able to respond to a virus like Ebola. If it were to come to a place, more developed or resource-rich place, such as the United States, I think we have the absolute correct resources to be able to respond effectively and efficiently to isolate somebody who may have symptoms or have that virus so that it would not take hold in a place like Europe or the United States.
Dr. Bill Fisher, he is at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sadly, Laurie Garrett, that's exactly what was said about HIV/AIDS when it began, and the isolation, the quarantine, the fear of spreading was downplayed in this country. Do you see that same thing happening here?
Well, we've already seen the UK government go on a special alert status, advising physicians across the UK to be on special awareness of the possibility of Ebola arriving in the UK. I think the danger point politically for global solidarity and for the whole nature of how the world community deals with this problem, the flashpoint will be if we ever actually do see spread inside Nigeria. Nigeria is the big kahuna of the African continent. It's the most populous country. It's a major oil producer, an economic powerhouse for the continent. It has two major international airports and a very highly mobile population that travels all over the world. Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, these are very, very desperately poor societies. The average person has never traveled anywhere except walking distance to another country nearby. But Nigeria would be a completely different state of affairs. And honestly, given the situation inside Nigeria right now politically, with Boko Haram having control of the northern provinces of the country, with the country facing a national election, with the disgrace of the 300 missing girls never accounted for, kidnapped by Boko Haram, and the history of the Islamist movement, of northern Nigeria opposing polio vaccination and at various points opposing other health interventions in the Muslim population in the north, I think we could be looking at a really serious powder keg. So if I can read the tea leaves right now on this African summit, while the Ebola epidemic is not on the agenda, I have to assume that the back table discussion will be, how do we contain this? How do we keep it from getting into Nigeria or into Senegal, another powerhouse economically in the region? How do we isolate these countries? And, of course, the danger of doing so is that they become sort of national pariahs in the same stigmatized sense that the average HIV patient was stigmatized here in the United States in the 1980s.
Dr. Fauci, do you agree with Laurie Garrett that Nigeria could be a tipping point?
Well, certainly. I mean, it would be terrible if it gets into the type of spread that we're seeing in the other three countries because, as Laurie said correctly, Nigeria is the most populous nation in Africa, and it's a nation that interacts very much with the rest of the world. The fact that the Nigerians right now, even though they are don't have the kind of healthcare structure that we have or that the Europeans have, they are on very high alert now about the situation, about making sure that this does not establish itself. But it could. And as Laurie said correctly, if it does, that would really be a big problem because of the size and the population of the country.
Would you see isolation as a result?
Well, you've got to be careful when you start talking about isolation. There are things that one can do that are appropriate, that are not infringing on people's literal basic human rights. The critical issue is what several of us have said throughout this dialogue here is to try and get an as organized as possible infrastructure, whether that's help from other organizations, other countries, or what have you, to be able to do the fundamental protocols of isolation and care so that people don't spread it from one to another.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the National Institutes of Health. Short break here, and when we come back, we'll open the phones for your questions, comments. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, best-selling writer Amy Bloom on her new novel, Lucky Us. It's a story of two teenage half-sisters who head to Hollywood and take us on a journey through 1940s America. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Right now, we're going to go straight to the phones to Sarah in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments. Well, first of all, I recently had to postpone a trip to Liberia that I was supposed to take in 2 weeks. So I've been following this outbreak since the beginning, back in March. But since then, so there's sort of been two things that I've found a little disheartening. The first is this outbreak sort of shows the fragility of a lot of the hospitals in places like Liberia. I mean, recently they had to close one of the more important hospitals in the capital, Monrovia, St. Joseph's Catholic Hospital. And then also you see a lot of the doctors, the major doctors who have been affected from this. So I was hoping the panelists could sort of talk about that. And then also the other disheartening thing that I've seen is that from the beginning, I heard that the World Health Organization talk a lot about how reduced funding has sort of affected their ability to deal with the Ebola outbreak. And so I was wondering if the panelists could talk about that.
You have quite a number of questions there. What about the fragility of hospitals, Dr. Fisher?
Absolutely. I think the caller hit on a number of key issues. One is that there are such an under-resourced area. So the lack of basic healthcare infrastructure essentially sets up this area to be overwhelmed by an outbreak. So that's a key point. And actually, I would say that even the resources that we're able to bring in are not sufficient. I think we need to increase the amount of resources both from a material perspective as well as a human perspective in order to be able to combat this outbreak.
Laurie Garrett, do you want to jump in?
Quick things. The average per capita spending, according to the World Bank, on health care per person in these countries is a high of $18 a year, a low of $7. So there's not a lot of health care delivery available if you're spending $7 per person per year on all health services combined. And as far as the question, I'm very glad the caller brought this up from Ann Arbor. Thank you. Funding and WHO. WHO is in severe budget crisis, has been now for almost 4 years. They've laid off 20% of total personnel of the institution, and their disease response capacity has seen its budget slashed. I know that the average listener imagines that there's this huge SWAT team of health providers sitting in WHO headquarters at Geneva, and at the snap of a finger, the director general deploys them where needed. This is absolutely untrue. In fact, WHO goes around begging for people like Dr. Fisher to, at the expense of somebody else, the U.S. government, for example, to go in under the WHO flag where needed. And our own CDC has seen our budget cut for international response capacity, pandemic response, and surveillance. So actually, we're less prepared today than we were perhaps 10 years ago in terms of the budgetary constraints of the major responders.
Dr. Fisher, do you want to comment?
I totally agree. That was exactly my experience. I think my contract was for a dollar, but there is hope. There are people who want to go there and help out. And so what the work that WHO does and is able to do, even with a slash budget, is Herculean.
We have several tweets and emails on this question. Please ask why doctors are dying, even with all the precautions being taken. Dr. Fauci.
Well, as we say, the predominant way of transmitting is by direct contact to body fluids.
But don't okay. The doctors have uniforms?
Indeed, they do. But you've got to understand, and Billy Fisher will I'm sure verify that for me. If you look at the conditions under which you have to put on these suits, these masks, these goggles, these gloves, when it's 100 degrees out.
Just like Hollywood.
Yeah, just putting it on and taking it off. I mean, I worked in isolation facilities where it's an air-conditioned room when you put on those spacesuits and it's uncomfortable, even when you do it for 20 minutes. Could you imagine 3-4 hours at a time having to put it on and take it off? And in fact, it's not only the doctors and the healthcare providers who are at high risk of getting infected, but even the people who assist them in putting the personal protective equipment on and off. So when you're exposed and when you're there and getting into direct contact with the bodily fluids, that puts you at risk, and that's exactly the reason why doctors and healthcare providers are getting infected.
Dr. Fisher.
Absolutely. I'd echo all of those comments. It's not just the protective equipment, which is critical, as Dr. Fauci mentioned, but it's how you put it on and, more importantly, how you take it off. And so, and in addition to that,
what do you mean how you take it off?
So it's a great point. So when When you put in all this equipment, it can get as hot as about 115, 116 degrees on an average temperature day inside your suit. And then you work for as long as you can before you start becoming very dehydrated. And then you have to exit. But you have to take off your equipment in exactly the same way every single time. So Doctors Without Borders, MSF, has established these rules, these routines that really provide a safe way of removing these clothes which have potentially infectious bodily fluids on them. But there's one other thing that I wanted to comment on is that not only do you have these incredibly hot and restrictive suits, but you also have the emotional and physical fatigue of trying to provide care with incredibly limited resources to a large number of people who are dying. And that should not be underestimated in terms of its effect on the person, because fatigue and time that you're in a facility and that you're taking care of people can weaken your ability to do all of these rules the right way each time.
Laurie Garrett.
One point I saw in the 95 Ebola epidemic is that, of course, all the foreigners are also taking anti-malarial drugs to protect themselves from acquiring malaria on site. Some of those drugs have the impact of affecting your psychological outlook rather severely. And you add that on top of this whole business of trying to deal with the emotional atmosphere, it's easy to make a mistake. We now know in the SARS epidemic in 2003 in Hong Kong, the difference from one hospital to another in the rate of infection and death in healthcare workers was almost 100% about exactly what Dr. Fisher was talking about, how you get out of your protective gear, and whether or not you touch in the wrong sequence your mask, your gloves, your own face, and end up actually contaminating yourself from your own equipment.
Dr. Lucy.
Yes, I'd like to follow on to Dr. Garrett's comment. I went to Hong Kong during SARS and then worked in a SARS-designated hospital in Toronto, Scarborough General, in 2003 in June. And in both places, there were very strict rules about the sequence of putting on your personal protective equipment, but again, as Dr. Fisher said, even more importantly, taking it off so that you don't inadvertently expose yourself and infect yourself to a virus that's on the protective equipment itself. And so there's always at least a two-person team when you had to put on your protective equipment, someone to not just guide you, but to stop you if you're doing the wrong thing. You're not following the exact sequence.
But couldn't those two people, once you're starting to take the uniform off, couldn't they be affected by your bodily fluid?
Well, certainly, I think as Dr. Fauci was alluding to, that they are at risk as well. And so you have to be very, very careful to follow a very strict written criteria. And often there's a senior nurse or doctor or sort of a safety officer who would watch the process of putting on and taking off the personal protective.
How many health officials, doctors, nurses, do we know have died? Dr. Fisher.
That's a tough statistic to get a hold of, because the majority of healthcare workers that become infected and die actually do so in the beginning of an epidemic before it's recognized. And so I actually don't know the actual number.
Do you, Dr. Fauci?
No, okay. I don't. But what Dr. Fisher is referring to is that When you start in the epidemic, people are not on high alert the way they are right now.
Right.
And people come into the emergency room, you think somebody has malaria or a bad case of diarrhea, and you're the emergency room physician. You put yourself at very high risk before the high alert comes out.
Laurie Garrett.
Well, the best estimate I've heard is 60, with the majority of them actually being the Red Cross workers who perform the heroic duty of trying to actually remove ailing individuals from their families in village level and bring them into a quarantine facility. They're the ones that face attacks, resistance. They may get into a scuffle. Their protective gear may be compromised in the process. I know we're all very focused right now on two heroic American physicians that are fighting for their lives right now with Ebola on the ground. But their demise was preceded by the top physician from Uganda who came in to offer his services, having been in the Ugandan outbreak years ago. The number one physician for Sierra Leone passed away due to Ebola just this week. And as I say, the best estimate we've got is about 60 healthcare workers.
Wow.
In an area that is very, very, very deficient in healthcare worker talent to begin with.
All right. To Zach in Silver Spring, Maryland, you're on the air.
Oh, awesome. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to ask Dr. Fisher, I've been tracking this whole thing, and I read the hot zone before this happened. So I have a really small idea of what Ebola is. My question is that they said that it's related to Ebola, Zaire. Could it still be possible spreading through the air that way, or is it just only through direct contact with the fluid?
So thanks, Zach, for that question. All of the epidemiologic studies that have looked at transmission of Ebola, and including this virus, suggest that it's only through direct or indirect contact, but that it's not airborne.
All right. And Dr. Fauci, I'm wondering about a vaccine.
Right. Well, right now there are several candidates that are in development for a vaccine for Ebola, some of them looking really quite promising. It's very interesting that years ago we began the development of a vaccine for Ebola and looked pretty good in a non-human primate model. One of the problems we faced is that it was very difficult to get pharmaceutical company interest in the development of that because of the fact that there were these mini outbreaks since 1976, and up to the present time, there were only, you know, about 2,300 total cases. But now we're seeing an intensive interest in it. There's a few candidates, one of which I might mention very briefly, Diane, is really looking good. It was a candidate was developed at the Vaccine Research Center at the NIH. We've done it in animals, and it is very protective in animals to challenge. And now we're getting ready to go in the early fall, likely the first week or two of September, in what we call phase one testing in humans to make sure it's safe and that it induces an immune response. That, by necessity, will take several months, so that probably by mid-January we'll know if we have a vaccine that's safe and that can induce the response that we want. If we do, then pharmaceutical companies will get interested in gearing up and making available predominantly to healthcare workers.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Lucy, I want to go back to the bats. Have bats always been known to be carriers of the Ebola virus?
No, they've been suspected for quite a few years, but it's only now with this outbreak that World Health Organization, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and other organizations have really put a high likelihood that they are a source of the infection. But again, along with multiple other animals, African antelopes, chimps, gorillas, other animals that are often eaten as bushmeat by people, and therefore people can get infected.
So what I'm wondering is this something new in the atmosphere? Is this something new in the soil? Is this something new, or is it one of those? I mean, why these outbreaks, Dr. Fauci?
Well, first of all, we don't know for sure, but if you look at outbreaks of new human diseases, about 70% of them are what we call zoonotic, Diane. They come from an animal to a human. So it is very likely that this virus has been around for a very long time, and it is only a circumstances of what likely happens is that there's human encroachment on environments that they were not in before, where people get in close proximity to different animals, and that's how you get the spread. Could be related to a mutation or not that makes it more likely that it would then infect a human. But in direct answer to your question, it is likely that these viruses have been around for a very long time, and we just happened to notice the first outbreak that we were able to identify in 1976.
Laurie Garrett, at this point, would you discourage yourself or anyone else you know from traveling to Guinea, Sierra Leone, or Liberia?
Well, personally, I go everywhere, so I'm a bad example, perhaps.
With a bad cold, I might add.
Yes, apologies to the listeners for my foghorn voice today.
Oh, listen, no apology necessary.
But You know, what I would like to add is something that to what Dr. Fauci just said. You know, it's very interesting, Diane, that we see a long list of relatively newly recognized diseases, starting with Ebola, Marburg, Nipah, Lyssa, MERS, SARS. It's a long list, all of which seem to be associated with migratory fruit bats. And these are very shy animals. They live high in the canopies of rainforests. They're the great pollinators of planet Earth, like bees to flowers. The bats are pollinating our rainforests. Without them, we would have no rainforests. And yet, they're clearly stressed, these populations. I don't think the answer to your caller's question is something intrinsic in the soil or of that nature. Rather, the question is, are we so stressing these populations of bats that they're taking risks which these shy animals, these nocturnal animals, would never normally take, coming closer to human habitation, coming closer to human agriculture, because they're basically starving.
All right, and we'll have to leave it at that. Laurie Garrett, Dr. Billy Fisher, Dr. Daniel Lucy, Dr. Anthony Fauci, thank you all so much. We'll keep an eye on this. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment.